me regresé a mi tierra, porque aquí no quepo yo. Quiero recordarle al gringo, yo no crucé la...
Good evening, I'm Loreto Rojas.
And I'm Cal Winslow.
We are very happy to be back, this time again as part of Hispanic Heritage Month. Today, and in the programs to follow, we will consider an aspect of this heritage, both in an immediate sense, the crisis on the border, and in the background to this current crisis, immigration in and the United States.
So, Loreto, I guess we might have hoped. It's been a year now since we did our first heritage program, that things had gotten a bit better there on the border. It seems to be not so much in the headlines anymore. But alas, when one looks at it, it just seems like things are getting worse.
Yes, and that's the reason I think it's so important that we keep on covering this topic, because there is a real crisis happening at the border, and we need to learn more about the people that are involved and working there.
So thus far, we've covered a lot. We looked at DACA. We've talked about zero tolerance and about the children in the cages on the border and about Latino youth. And by the way, these programs can all be found on KZYX on the website. Look under Programs, then Public Affairs. But today, we're extremely lucky. We have with us one of our country's leading young scholars on Latino issues, Rocio Rosales, an assistant professor at the University of California, Irvine.
Rocio Rosales is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at UC Irvine. She completed her PhD in sociology at ACLA, University of California, Los Angeles, in 2012, and received her AB in sociology, cum laude, with a certificate in Latin American Studies from Princeton University. Her research appears in the Journal of Ethnic and Migration Studies and Ethnic and Racial Studies. She is the author of Fruteros, Street Vending, Illegality, and Ethnic Community in Los Angeles, forthcoming at UC Press.
So today we're going to talk to Professor Rosales about her work interviewing immigrants in Southern California. But first, if you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You've sent us a fascinating biography, and of course there are many sides to this border story.
Let me say hello to Rocio first. Hi, Rocio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us today. And it's okay if we call you Rocio?
Yes.
Wonderful. So I have learned that you grew up in El Paso, is that right?
Yes, I was born and raised in El Paso in a small clinic located a few blocks from the Paso del Norte International Bridge, and spent pretty much all my life less than 3 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border.
So would you mind to tell us how it was to be in a small child in that city?
It's a fascinating life to grow up in a border, because I think we have a very different understanding of cross-border life when you live so close, that later on in life, when I went, you know, farther into the country, people don't acknowledge or understand how much movement there is between the United States and Mexico. And I think my family was reflective of that movement. My entire life, my father worked as a taxi driver in Juarez, and my mother worked as a garment worker in El Paso. So my father would cross the border into Juarez to work as a driver, and throughout the day, he would take trips in and out of El Paso, you know, dropping off passengers and then returning to Juarez to pick up others.
So this is the famous Ciudad Juarez, right, in the border, that sometimes we hear news about it.
yes, somewhat infamous. You know, it has developed all of its issues.
Right, because, you know, I was thinking that, sorry to interrupt you, but I was thinking that you're talking about your father coming and going from the border, and it seems to me that that was then, right?
Yes.
It was easier to move.
It was easier. It was faster. There was definitely less restriction. The lines were less long than they are now. I mean, now I think the average time is 2 hours to cross into the United States from Juarez. So that kind of lifestyle that my father led and his ability to cross back and forth several times in one day would seem very difficult in contemporary times.
And your mom worked on both sides of the border?
So from a very early age, my mom started fixing her legal status. And so I believe my grandfather started helping my mother fix her legal status when she was a teenager. So she came over as a legal resident, and she started working at a garment factory that was also about a mile away from the bridge. And she worked at a garment factory with many other Latina women. After NAFTA, that factory actually crossed the border back into Mexico, and so she lost her job. So it was an interesting flip. She had come into the United States to work, but her work actually crossed back into Mexico.
Hmm.
So,
did your family go back and forth on holidays, or?
We did. So half of my family lives in Juarez, my aunts, my uncles. And for a long time, we had a house in Juarez. So we would spend the week working and going to school in El Paso. And then weekends, we would go and spend in the house that we had in Juarez and spend our time with our extended family there. And it allowed my family to handle the stress of being in a new country with this like weekend release in Juarez. So it was a very binational life that I led up until high school, when we sold the house in Juarez and really more firmly established ourselves in El Paso.
So you mentioned that your grandfather helped your mother to gain a legal status. Was he part of the Bracero programs?
He was a Bracero. He had come intermittently throughout the years. He worked both as an agricultural worker, but he also worked for the railroads for some time. And so he was an itinerant migrant. He would come into the United States, work, and then return to Juarez once, you know, the agricultural season had ended. But he had fixed his status, and so he helped my mother fix her status. But my mom started her legal paperwork, her status to establish residency, when she was a teenager, and she actually didn't become a citizen until she was about 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just to give you a sense of how long the process takes, it's an inordinate amount of time from establishing residency to working and living in the United States to, you know, that moment when you can call yourself a U.S. citizen. And my mom's life is an indication of how long that process is.
And was this sort of life unusual, normal for a family in El Paso?
I don't think it was unusual for families that lived so close to the border. I know that I went to a high school, Bui High School, which is one block away from the International Bridge. And I had many friends who spent part of their life in Juarez, either because they also had family in Juarez, or sometimes they lived in Juarez and they commuted to school. My family had originally done that when we were younger, just because the cost of living was much lower in Juarez. But there came a point where Border Patrol agents actually told my family that they couldn't do that. And so at that point, my family moved to El Paso and, you know, started renting various apartments so that the commute was not across an international bridge. But it still happens. Many of the university students at the University of Texas at El Paso commute from Juarez. And so even the infrastructure now in El Paso is being built to facilitate that movement with a direct highway connecting the International Bridge to the University of Texas at El Paso, recognizing that so much of the student body is actually a Mexican student population that is coming and studying at UTEP. So there's a really great acknowledgement in El Paso of this binational life, and you can see it reflected not only in how people talk about Juarez and El Paso, but in the infrastructure itself, right? That it facilitates this movement of people and commerce between cities. And I think outsiders don't understand how interlaced our communities are. And they often think that you can build a border, but this is a long-standing relationship, and they're not just our neighbors. It's a sister city.
And your own education, you mentioned UTEP, your own education, was it bilingual, or what was schooling like for you as a youngster?
All of my education was in the United States, elementary school, middle school, and high school in El Paso. Most of all of the schools that I went to were about 99% Mexican-American students. But I went to schools where they really, despite this large population of Latino students, teachers often wanted us to only speak English in all spaces. And so it was just interesting, right? The way in which sometimes language would be policed, given that so many of the students were Mexican-Americans. I certainly benefited from being able to grow up in the United States, and I watched a lot of Sesame Street growing up, so I picked up the language quickly. But I do remember spaces in school when I would speak Spanish to my friends and teachers would, you know, limit that. And then I would come home where I had a father who was very strict about me not speaking Spanglish because he was really concerned that I would lose my Spanish. And so anytime I would get lazy and replace a Spanish word with English, he would make it a point to stop the conversation and correct me, because he was terrified that I would lose my Spanish. And that was really important to him, you know? It was very important that I be able to communicate in his language, because he didn't want to feel a distance with his kids. And it was very valuable to be able to have that lesson early on, because years later, when I start doing research, my ability to speak Spanish and connect with the respondents is crucial to me getting the information that I need. So I'm very thankful that my father was that strict in the house so that I was able to maintain my language.
Well, that's something that we witnessed in our area too, where many parents actually have this issue. Perhaps they haven't been so strong with their kids as your father was, where they cannot really speak Spanish back. I know many that they understand everything, and I'm so glad you're mentioning this, because I think it's very important to keep, if you have the opportunity to be bilingual, why not to be proficient at both languages? So I congratulate your father for being strong in this sense.
Can I come in here,
yes.
Loretto? Maybe we should just say, do you have a word to say about the shooting and the prominence now of El Paso in the world news?
I can't seem to make sense of it, because I remember for a long time I would tell my peers, my colleagues, that El Paso mattered, right? That we needed to be on the map, and that so many things that are happening in the country that El Paso was a microcosm for, all these tensions and frustrations. And it's really strange now to hear El Paso in the news continuously, but it's linked to a massacre. And so now when I hear El Paso, it's always the El Paso massacre. And this is not what I had wanted for my city. I haven't been able to return to El Paso since the shooting, but I have, you know, I have friends from high school and my family, and they're all trying to make sense of what happened. I think we all had this belief that it would never happen in El Paso because it is such a safe city. And even my family, it took them a few days for it to hit. I know that my mom, who I talked to fairly regularly, the day that it happened, we talked early on and the news was still coming in, so we were confused about what had happened. Then when my good friends from high school was on the news, as you know, being proclaimed as a hero because she had ushered some people out of the store. And I realized how close it was, because even though El Paso is a large city, it has a small town feel to it. And so when my mother finally called me on that Saturday, she called me in the evening, and I remember she called me and she just started crying. And then I started crying. And that was the call. You know, after she finished, she said, you know, okay, mija, I'll talk to you later. And I think we both just needed that release, because the severity of what had happened had finally hit us and settled in. And it's very difficult reality. You know, not only the shooting, but the hatred that was behind it and the motivations and the idea that we felt like targets for a long time. And the El Paso massacre was the first time when we were literally targets, not just of rhetoric, but of actual bullets. Yes. So it's been very difficult.
Yes, Rocia, one only can imagine how difficult must be in so many levels, particularly when we see we have been doing this program for, we have had a few series and we have covered many topics, but one of the things that is really difficult is this depiction of the Latino community as being dangerous or rapist, you know, what our president has been saying and describing Latinos and particularly Mexicans. And it really worries us that there is sort of a campaign from the top of the government creating this animosity against a group of people that actually, in its majority, are just hardworking families and people that have achieved so much and gone and studied as you have done. And so it's important that we talk these topics, and my heart goes to you and your community for enduring this. So let's keep on talking about your work. And I was noticing here on your biography that you attended Princeton University and you're majored in sociology, and you have a minor in Latin American studies. So how did you make it to that university?
I knew that I wanted to go away for college, and I actually have a very high, an overachieving older sister who went to Harvard before me. So she was a trailblazer, and she was actually instrumental in teaching me, you know, giving me the social capital that I needed to be able to understand what colleges to apply to. She really liked Princeton because she knew that it was a smaller school. She actually received her MA from Princeton, and so encouraged me to go there because she felt that it would be a good experience for me, and I did. But it was a completely different reality. You know, I'm coming from a working class border town where I had no friends of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. To Princeton University, where, you know, it's a predominantly white institution, very rich students from the upper echelon of American society and many other Latin American societies, because I had a lot of Latin American friends. So it was a culture shock for me, definitely. But I think that it was fundamental to, you know, the development of my interest in sociology, to my career. I had wonderful professors, and I gravitated towards sociology because it felt like I understood the material, because it was a reality. You know, a lot of these issues that are covered in sociology classes about immigration, about race, poverty, they're realities that I had known but didn't analyze. And so the discipline itself allowed me to make sense of a lot of things that I had grown up with this academic lens. And so,
yeah. So Rocio, you mentioned mm-hmm. something, and you said that your sister showed you kind of the ropes how to get there. Could you explain that to us? Because many times when I go to our high school here in Fort Bragg, where there is a majority of Latino students, I always want to encourage them to go to college, but I don't really understand what they can do at the high school level in order to get into these universities. So could you give us a little bit of insight into that?
Well, I mean, I think, so both of my parents only have a grade school education. And so having my sister go to college, and she's much older than I am, from a very early age, she went away to college when I was in, I think, middle school. So her going away to college planted the seed that college was an inevitability for me. Not maybe I should go to college, but I will go to college. And when I do go to college, I'm going to go to the best university that has the capacity to give me the best funding because it's an option. And so really my sister served as just acknowledgement that it was possible, that it could happen, and that it was going to happen. And so she would come home, and she, you know, I remember she would come home with a lot of ideas, but also I could tell that she was stressed out about my preparation. And so I remember one time she came home for the summer, and she was like, "You have to learn how to play chess. Everyone in college plays chess," you know. And so she taught me as a middle schooler to play chess. But I also recognize that my sister had a full ride to Harvard, and my parents did not want to let her go to Harvard. And my father, you know, I think they were both afraid, maybe it's a cultural thing, they were afraid of letting her go so far away. They were afraid because she was a woman. And my father told my sister, only geniuses and millionaires go to Harvard, and you're neither, you know, to kind of discourage her from going. And my sister was very hard-headed, and she said, "I'm going with or without your bendición," you know, and which is a big deal in our family. And so she left without their blessing. And around Thanksgiving of her first year, my parents were, you know, they missed her. They didn't like the way that she had gone, and they apologized to her, and she came back for Christmas, and they were happy. And you know, they knew that she wasn't going to change, that it was going to happen. And so several years later, my sister finishes undergrad, goes to graduate school. She comes home and gets a wonderful job and becomes the head of household, you know. And at that point, as I'm witnessing this as a kid, so I'm seeing her decisions be vindicated by, you know, her ability to take care of the family. And my parents really understanding that they made a mistake in preventing her and that they should have embraced it. And so I'm the last child of four, and with me, they definitely corrected themselves, and they urged me to go to, you know, to fly and to be as or more successful than my sister. And I don't think that often happens in families, right? And I think more often there's that tension that exists between parents who don't know what college will be like for their kids and who are terrified of an experience that they don't understand themselves. And I understand where my parents were coming from when they didn't want to let my sister go, because they were terrified for her, because they wanted to keep her safe. Because they had already, you know, as immigrants, they already know what it's like to be venturing into the unknown, you know. And so because my sister did that, I was able to follow, and it was, there was less resistance. And so
she planted the seed and opened the door.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And pushed me through. So I benefited from that. But I think there's something about just having a force in your life that makes college seem like it's going to happen. And many students who come from families where their parents don't go to college, this idea of college being inevitable is not a thing. And so it's a large form of resistance, right? Which is why I think for students who are in low-income households and high schools, it's important from a very early age to just talk about college as something that's going to happen. Not maybe, not if you're lucky, but it has to happen, just like it does for middle and upper class households, where going to college is almost never a question. It's just going to happen.
Rocio, that's really terrific, wonderful, really. But we are going to pause here for just a few seconds, because this is Loreto Rojas, and it's Cal Winslow, and we're your hosts today. And this is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio, listener-supported. We're starting a new series of talking about California just in time for Hispanic Heritage Month. And this morning we're talking to Rocio Rosales, who's a professor of sociology at UC Irvine. Maybe we should move on now, if it's all right with you, to your research project and what seems to be taking up your many talents, obviously, today.
So when I first arrived at UC Irvine, I was approached by a graduate student about working with the local organization that facilitates visits between volunteers and immigrant detainees at detention centers. And so, you know, I became involved with an organization as a volunteer, just wanting to assess what was going on. The point of the local organization was to end immigrant isolation in detention. But that was really the seed for the second major research project that I took on. And, you know, I was really interested in immigrant detention, of the experiences of people who were being detained. I knew then we had statistics that showed that over 80% of all detainees didn't have legal representation. We know that the immigration proceedings process is very complicated. And so one of the sort of motivations that I had for entering this space was really understanding how immigrant detainees, who sometimes had language barriers, who almost never had legal representation, navigated the system. How did they make sense of it? How did they talk to each other in detention about their cases? And so I created a small research team consisting of both undergraduate and graduate students to begin the interview process. And I did a call among UCI undergraduates for, you know, applications to join the team, and I was pleasantly surprised by the response among undergraduate students.
So is this sponsored by your department, Rocio, or was it funded separately, or how did you?
So when I began the research, there was no funding. Since starting, I've received a small grant from the UCLA Labor Center, which funds research at various UCs. And then later I received another small fund from the Mellon Foundation just to be able to pay the students who work with me. And it's a small team of five to six students. Many of them have already graduated. But really it's just I had students who wanted to join the project to learn how to do research, to learn how to do interviews, but also because the topic was very close to their hearts. I actually on the team had three DACA students, three undergraduate DACA students, and one graduate student who was also DACA. And so, you know, they were motivated by an interest in the topic, by wanting to make sense of something that was very close to home. But I'm currently and I'm always seeking funding for this project.
So when did you start it?
We started in January of 2016. So very slowly visiting one facility in Southern California, doing interviews, and then we expanded to two facilities and tried to vary the populations that we were interviewing to have a really good representation of the different experiences of detainees in detention.
Could you describe these centers or whatever we want to call them? And was it difficult to get in, and what were the authorities like? But so in California, do we have lots of them? A few? What's going on?
California and Texas actually have the... So in 2015, every state in the country had one or more detention facility. And Texas and California actually have the highest number of facilities and the highest number of detainees. So I think in 2014, the figure was about 250 facilities nationwide, and averaging about 34,000 immigrants in detention. So those figures are growing because we know that private facilities are being, we know that there's a backlog of cases. If you come into this country as an asylum seeker, detention is almost exclusively mandatory. So if you come into this country and declare asylum at a port of entry, you're put into either a city jail or a minimum security prison while your case is being heard. And, you know, that can be a very long process that is sometimes lengthened So in the case of our study, we had one detainee who was from Ghana, and he spoke a limited English, but his language was Ga. It's a language that not many people speak, and because they couldn't find an interpreter who spoke Ga, his case actually was extended over almost a year. Just he couldn't even go before an immigration judge because there was a language barrier. So it was not that the case was being heard and appealed. It was that it could not be heard and understood by the detainee or by the immigrant judge because they could not find a translator who spoke English in Ga.
So how is the place where this man was actually held for a year?
He was held for over a year, and actually among the detainees we're tracking how they make sense of it, but also, you know, how discouraged or encouraged are they by this process. And he was one of the ones that we were following consistently who was dejected, who, you know, what we see is a lot of these migrants who are coming from African countries come with a lot of faith and hope in the U.S. system, right? They believe that they're coming to a country that is just and fair, with optimism, speaking of, you know, UN policy. And when they find themselves in, you know, the yellow jumpsuits in a minimum security prison, it collapses their understanding of what the United States is, because they talk about not being criminals, but coming into this country and being treated like criminals. So one of the things that we're writing about in our work is how this understanding of the legal process is just torn asunder by the detention process, right? Immigrants who come with faith and optimism in our system quickly lose that faith and optimism throughout their time in detention.
Right, because they are not criminals, but are treated like criminals by being put in these detention centers that are more like jails, right? Prisons?
Right. I mean, they come because they have religious or political claims to asylum, and, you know, they see themselves as victims, and they are often victims, especially when we started interviewing detainees at a module that had trans detainees. Many of the transgendered women that we were interviewing still had the physical markers of their abuse, you know. So when you make a claim for asylum, you have to show proof that you're fleeing violence or life-threatening situations. And so for these trans women, having stab wounds or bruises, the physical markers of what they were fleeing was grim and horrible to witness, and the stories were very compelling. And they often had their claims, they did receive asylum, right? Because it was so apparent that they were fleeing for their lives. It becomes more difficult for an African detainee who is fleeing his home country because of political or religious threats, right? Or political or religious-based threats. It doesn't make the claim any less severe or important, but it does make it more difficult because of the way that the system is set up to prove that you are fleeing a life-threatening situation in your home country.
How does someone from Africa or Asia end up in California at the border?
So a lot of them had very interesting migration routes. For a long time, they were flying primarily to Brazil and trying to establish themselves or seek a life for themselves there. I think the visa entry into Brazil was easier at the time. It's becoming a little bit more complicated for them to fly from their country to Brazil. But then from Brazil, they would start their journey north through South America and Latin America. And, you know, even they followed a migratory route that is fairly common, because we would interview several of them who did not come together and came from different countries, and they talked about the same migratory path. And really what they discuss is grim, because they talk about walking through rainforests where not only would they see abandoned suitcases in the middle of the rainforest, but they would also see people who had succumbed to the journey, right? That they would pass bodies, and they talk about, all these ways in which they evaded death, just going through rivers and forests, and the racism that they sometimes experienced in Mexico, all to make their way to the U.S.-Mexico border, where they would present themselves at a point of entry and seek asylum after this long and arduous journey, sometimes on foot, through most of South America and Latin America. So.
Right, and we have, at least I have heard the stories of them walking, that they never thought they will walk so much to get to the border. And of course they expected during this trip that the United States will be this angel that will be with their open arms, saving them from this horrible situation because of the American dream and all the ideas that are permeated through movies and other types of media. So, but they ended in these detention centers and for a very long time, as you are describing. So we really would like to hear more about how are these places. I mean, they are really looking like prisons or they are converted schools. We have also heard that some kids are held on barracas, you know, how is it said in English, large former box stores. So how they are? How do they look?
Well, I mean, the facilities that we're visiting here in Southern California are established facilities. They're often city jails or minimum security jails, minimum security prisons. And so they have ICE has contracts with the cities that allot them a certain number of beds. So for one facility, which was a city jail, the local city made an agreement with ICE to give them a set number of beds just for their detainees. And so recently, this city ended its contract with ICE and took back the allotment of beds at the city jail. And so ICE can no longer house detainees there. One of the other facilities is a minimum security facility that's already set up with a population of incarcerated folks, and so they designate one housing unit for just the immigrant detainees. So it's one building that's designated for only immigrant detainees, and they wear yellow jumpsuits, whereas the other incarcerated individuals will wear white or blue jumpsuits. So the jumpsuits distinguish them, the housing unit distinguishes them, but they're housed in a minimum security facility that's already meant for people who have broken the law. In places like the border, we see more of these temporary encampments being built. And a lot of those are being used to house families because the nature of immigrants is changing, right? From single men to families to women to children. And so I know less of that type of structure because they're quickly being built to house a completely different demographic of asylum seeking immigrants. And most of those different facilities are being built along the border. So just outside of El Paso, there's one which I think is similar to what you're describing, which is like a barrack style encampment for families that are coming in. But the facilities that we are focusing on are definitely established facilities that are meant for the housing of people with convictions, right? So with criminal records who are serving out their sentences. And so immigrant detainees are just being incorporated into that prison industrial complex that exists, right? The infrastructure, the security guards. And like I said, ICE just has contracts with these facilities so that part of, the ICE pays these facilities to basically guard and secure immigrant detainees.
And you know there's a big argument on the two sides of the American divide today about what ICE is really all about. You hear the spokespeople for ICE saying that they're committed nice people, I guess. And then you hear other stories. What's your own experience with ICE? And then you mentioned to me some contradictions in the whole relationship between ICE and its opponents and other progressives in the border area. Maybe you could bring us up to date there, because the legal situation seems to be changing so often and so rapidly.
Right. I think one of the things that's happening continuously is that policy is changing very quickly. So every day we hear of new policies that are ending asylum practices as we know them, or put into question longstanding policies like the Flores settlement, which, you know, the Flores settlement set a 20-day limit for the holding of children. And so under the current administration, they're trying to change that so that children can be held for longer periods of time in detention, with this understanding that they're being held for longer because they're trying to keep families together. So, you know, they're justifying the increasing time that children are kept in custody because of family, keeping families together, which, you know, it's a grim sort of balance that they're trying to do in justifying removing the Florida settlement, which is really meant to not have abusive practices towards children, right? There's no scenario in which children should be held in a minimum security facility meant for adults, but also it's just incomprehensible that we had a policy to limit that, and now the current administration is trying to go back on that policy. And, you know, even the way that asylum is practiced. Now, asylum seekers, like these African migrants who are coming through Brazil, would have to seek asylum in one of the intermediary countries and be denied before making their way to the United States. And that would change the population that we're seeing, because many of the asylum seekers that we're interviewing came through these countries to migrate because their dream was to seek asylum from the United States, who they perceive to be, you know, a country that they perceive to be just and fair. But in terms of understanding the ecology of immigrant detention in Southern California, there are a lot of moving parts. So we know that at least in this sort of small corner of the immigrant detention universe in Southern California, that there are activists who are working hard to end immigrant detention, right? Because they believe that if a city is a sanctuary city, it should also not have ICE holding detainees within the city limits. And so when activists try to push or exert pressure on local governments to end contracts with ICE, it helps move those facilities out of these cities, right? This pressure in our context, we've seen this pressure from activists push local governments into not renewing contracts with ICE, right? Not allotting bed space to immigrant detainees in their local jails. But we know that all actions have unintended consequences. And so one of the things that's happening now is because these facilities are closing in Southern California, these immigrant detainees are being transferred to other facilities, both public and private. But these facilities that they're transferred to are often farther away and in rural places where, you know, oversight isn't provided by public counsel lawyers, by immigrant activists, by volunteer visitors. So even though on the local level it's a win to close down a facility, if you're following an immigrant detainee and he or she travels from a facility in Southern California to a farther facility in a rural part of the United States, they're less accessible by lawyers and volunteers, but also by their family members. So the next phase of our research is to understand where the immigrant detainees are being transferred and if conditions at the new facility are comparable or if they're worse, right? Because then we begin to understand activism in a different light. But this doesn't make the activism any less important. It just, as a researcher, it's important to understand how all these pieces fit together and the implications for actions on one end to people on another end, right?
So how many people are you interviewing and how many cases are you following at this time?
So to date, we have about 40 interviews with detainees. And of these, some have been deported. A very few have actually had their claims, have received some form of asylum. Many of the trans detainees, like I said, have very strong claims. And so they're the ones who have the highest rates of success. We're adding about another 60 interviews to the mix. We mostly have men in the study and some women who are transgender women. So we're trying to expand the study to include women's experiences too. And we've also included different languages. So now we're interviewing people who speak Spanish, English, Portuguese, and hopefully we'll add a few more, you know, once I expand my study team of researchers who speak other languages, we can access different populations of people. So for now, it's just those three languages which we're working with and seeking the experiences of, you know, detainees, English, Spanish, or Portuguese. And by the time we're finished, we're hoping to have 100 interviews with detainees from all different countries, men, women, trans folks, just to have a really good understanding of what the experience is like, what their migration looked like leading into, you know, coming into the country. And the other thing that's going to be changing is the type of migrants held in custody, right? Because all these policies that are changing, asylum policies that are calling into question things like the Flores settlements, are going to have an effect on the type of person who makes their way into a border checkpoint and then ultimately into an immigrant detention center. And so in the next few months, when we continue doing these interviews, now that school is starting and I have my team assembled again, I'm sure we're going to be hearing different narratives because the policy affects the demographics of the people that we're capturing in these facilities and that we then interview as researchers.
So a couple of quick questions. Did I read that California was closing down the privately owned detention centers or not?
So I'm not entirely sure about California's policy, but I do know that private detention centers are increasing in number. I know that, you know, when one of the facilities that we were interviewing at closed down, word among the detainees was that they were going to be transferred to a private facility in Texas. And so one of the things that's very difficult for us as researchers is to keep track of where detainees are moved, just because even though you have a booking number and you could theoretically track them online, it takes several weeks sometimes for the system to be updated. And, you know, it's very frustrating for us to lose someone in detention, but we lose them as researchers, and it's important for our work. But when it's a family member who's trying to keep track of a loved one, where they are, where they're being moved to, where they're being housed, not having real-time information about where someone is physically can be very frustrating. And the system is set up so that it's very difficult to track someone as they're being transported from one facility to the other. And so we've actually struggled to find where the immigrants that we were interviewing were placed after this facility shut down. And so we're still trying to track some people down.
And I want to emphasize that these individuals are actually people that are seeking asylum. They are not really criminals, but they have are treated as criminals and move from one place to another without having actually committed any crimes.
Right.
Can you give us a quick update? I know it's not part of your project, on the situation of the children, the separated children.
Well, I mean, like I said, our study doesn't capture children. Everything that I know about the situation with the separated children comes from the news. And I mean, I think the only thing that I understand, at least from a researcher's point of view, is the changing demographics, right, of the higher incidence of children coming into this country, both on their own, but also in a family. And I don't think that the current administration has done much to reunify those children that were separated, but also to end the practices of separating children from their parents. So it's very tricky. I think one of the policies that they're putting forth now to keep families together and prevent the separation is actually the calling into question the Flores settlement, which is the current administration's solution to the separation of children from their families, is to hold children in detention for longer periods of time with their families. So in terms of the infrastructure that's being built, now we see more facilities that are being created to house entire families. So with like spaces that are meant for toddlers and spaces that are meant for adults. And, you know, the idea of having minimum security type prisons or jails being created to house families is a very grim outcome of everything that's happening, right? That the only way that we can make sense of their presence is by creating more facilities to incarcerate them.
Right. The Flores settlement established a 20-day limit for holding children. It was established in 1997. And it's one of the things that this current government wants to actually change, the 20-day limit, by actually incarcerating the whole family along with the kids, which doesn't seem to address the real problem here. So you are saying that there is a central problem of the immigration detention. Could you tell us again what is that problem?
Well, I mean, the central problem behind everything is that the policies are changing so quickly from this administration, and the system is expanding so quickly that it's outpacing our efforts as researchers to understand and make sense of detention. We have really important tools available that are emerging. So we have a Track Immigration website, which is based out of the University of Syracuse. And they're continuously updating, so they have freedom of information requests from the U.S. federal government, and they offer comprehensive, nonpartisan information about U.S. federal immigration enforcement. And so this is one of the best websites where you can go to access immigration prosecutions, ICE targeting the nature of charges for removal orders.
Excuse me, could you repeat the website?
So the website is Track Immigration, T-R-A-C, and it's based out of the University of Syracuse. And so it's a very basic website, but it has continuously updating reports, and it continuously gets information from ICE, from immigration courts. And so it's a kind of it's a catch-all for all the information that we're missing. And this website, more than any other that immigration researchers use, gives us that raw data that we need, right? The sheer numbers showing us the backlog of pending cases in immigration courts, showing us the average time pending cases have been waiting in immigration courts. And so not only does it give us the data, but they also use very helpful bar graphs showing us by fiscal year how many pending cases there are, how many removal orders were granted by immigration judges as of August 2019. And so as researchers, we depend on this website and the information that they're collecting to help us make sense of what's going on. But outside of this, it's very difficult to understand the system that's growing, that's, you know, researchers tend to work at a slower pace, right? We conduct interviews over long periods of time. We collect data at immigration courts. And it's difficult when something is growing so quickly that we can't make sense of it. But it's also difficult because these detention facilities and ICE are often not transparent institutions to researchers, to journalists. often don't have any oversight committees. And so increasingly we see each of these populations of researchers and journalists and committees getting shut out both by the policies put forth by the facilities, either by not allowing access or by their harder to reach locations in like rural settings as opposed to in Southern California. So, you know, it's important that they remain transparent about their policies so that we ensure that conditions on the ground for migrants and families remain somewhat palatable, given that they are still being incarcerated. But it doesn't seem that transparency is a goal of either ICE or the detention facilities. And I think more than anything, that's what we need to fight as researchers. You know, and as journalists, I'm sure they have interest in understanding what's going on beyond these photo ops that we see of, like, the Vice President Pence visiting a facility, beyond the limited access that reporters are often given. We need to understand what's happening on the ground, because otherwise this detention system is going to grow in a way that we might not approve of, that might be conditions that might be dangerous. And so more than anything, as a researcher, I'm interested and invested in keeping the immigrant detention system transparent. And so the TRAC website is one of the tools that we use to make sense of what's going on, right? So that we can keep track of the numbers, of the statistics by state, by judge, and really begin to make sense of what's happening and what these migrants are experiencing.
And this is why we are so lucky to have you to help us to understand this, because the picture is blur, and we know that people is being unjustly held in prisons. So thank you so much.
And I'm very sorry to say that we are running out of time. And just following up on Loretta's point, I think it's all also very important that we understand the courage that it takes, the courage and the dedication that it takes to speak up like people like yourself and your team have and are doing, and how important that is really for all of us wherever we are. Thanks to you and all of your colleagues. It really is encouraging in very difficult times to hear about your work.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me and for allowing me the space to talk about my research.
Gracias, Rocío. Hasta luego.
This is Loretta Rojas and Cal Winslow, and we're the hosts of Talking About California. Our guest this evening is the scholar, Professor Rocío Rosales.
This is the first in a new series in response to Hispanic Heritage Month. And we really appreciate talking today with Professor Rosales about her life, her career as a scholar at UC Irvine, as well as her work with Southern Californian immigrants. This is KZYX, Mendocino Community Listener Supported Radio. Thank you so much.
Porque aquí no quepo yo.